Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series. Issue 29, the guns. Let's listen to some history. Beginning in 1931 on East 107th Street.
This street marks gangland's greatest outrage, the machine gunning of five little children in cold blood. The street was filled with youngsters like these when the gangsters unleashed a hail of lead that swept the sidewalks. Here is Samuel DeVino, only 5 years old, pointing to where he was shot in the leg by gangland's ruthless gunmen. But poor little Samuel is more fortunate than Michael Vengale, also five. Michael met death, and this casket will hold his tiny body, broken by machine gun bullets.
That newsreel footage from 1931 reflected the concerns of the gangland era, Prohibition, Al Capone, the fearsome weapon of those days, the Thompson submachine gun, better known as the Tommy gun. Developed for trench combat like in World War I, the Tommy gun made its way into civilian life in the Prohibition era and made it into the news. U.S. Senator from New York, Royal Copeland, introduced a gun control bill in 1933 after incidents like that, with criteria unheard of before then.
We can never be free from the menace of promiscuous killings till the possession of firearms is everywhere restricted to persons of known character. To this end, I shall press my bill for passage through the United States Senate.
Persons of known character, he said. Democratic Senator Royal Copeland from New York, his character test did not become law, but the modern tension between gun rights and gun regulation in the name of public safety was being born, and the first federal gun control bill was passed in 1934, imposing a $200 tax on machine guns and sawed-off shotgun purchases and requiring that they all be listed in a federal gun registry. By the way, the NRA supported the bill. Nevertheless, the Firearms Act of 1934 was challenged in court on Second Amendment grounds, and the Supreme Court upheld the law in 1939, saying machine guns and sawed-off shotguns were not protected because they were not the types of weapons that would be carried by state militias. Back in the 1930s, the Supreme Court still thought the well-regulated militia clause of the Second Amendment meant more than it does today. Today, we think of Republicans as being for gun rights, Democrats, including most African Americans, as being for tighter regulation, but it wasn't always thus. Ronald Reagan, as governor of California in the 1960s, was well known for supporting a bill called the Mulford Act, which repealed California's open carry law. It was largely a response to the rise of the Black Panthers. As Governor Reagan noted during a Panthers protest of the bill in the state legislature in 1967. I have these Black Panthers up here with guns on the second floor, said Reagan. The original name of the group, mostly forgotten now, was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Panther co-founder Bobby Seale spoke at their protest in very Second Amendment terms.
Ronald Reagan is over here on the big front lawn. I got a statement to read.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general and the black people in particular to take careful note of the racist California legislature, which is now considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed and powerless at the very same time racist police agencies throughout the country are intensifying the terror, brutality, murder, and repression of black people.
Black Panther leader Bobby Seale in 1967. He'll be a guest in this series on Thursday of this week, by the way. He'll be on the show on Thursday. But how different from the Black Lives Matter movement, still concerned today about killings by police, but arming the black population is not among today's proposed solutions. The Mulford Act did pass. Californians lost the right to carry loaded weapons. And by the way, the NRA supported the bill. The next year, 1968, Congress passed the most comprehensive federal gun control law to date. It was years in the making, spurred first by the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. then by urban riots and the assassination of Martin Luther King in April of 68. On June 6, 1968, the day after Robert Kennedy was killed, the Gun Control Act of 1968 was signed by President Lyndon Johnson.
And some of you may be interested in knowing really what this bill does. It stops murder by mail order. It bars the interstate sale of all guns and the bullets that load them. It stops the sale of lethal weapons to those too young to bear their terrible responsibility. It puts up a big off-limits sign to stop gun runners from dumping cheap foreign $10 specials on the shores of our country.
President Johnson was proud, as you heard there, but he was also frustrated. Here's how far President Johnson wanted to go.
I ask for the national registration of all guns and the licenses of those who carry those guns. For the fact of life is that there are over 160 million guns in this country. More firearms than families. And if guns are to be kept out of the hands of the criminal and out of the hands of the insane and out of the hands of the irresponsible, then we just must have licensing. If the criminal with a gun is to be tracked down quickly, then we must have registration in this country. The voices that block these safeguards were not the voices of an aroused nation. They were the voices of a powerful lobby, a gun lobby, that has prevailed for the moment in an election year.
The powerful lobby he referred to was the NRA. By 1968, when Johnson spoke there, the NRA had come to its modern position of opposing almost any kind of firearms regulation. And as we see today, the NRA triumphs over public opinion. Encyclopedia.com says at that time, 80% of the public supported what Johnson spoke of there, gun registration. And the Gun Control Act was challenged at the Supreme Court. Of all things, the challenge was on behalf of a convicted felon who claimed that taking gun rights away from felons violated the Second Amendment. In a 1980 decision, in the case known as Lewis versus United States, that restriction was upheld. Part of the reason, according to the majority opinion, quote, the Second Amendment guarantees no right to keep and bear a firearm that does not have some reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia, unquote. They felt that felons weren't necessarily going to be included in that. So back in 1980, the Supreme Court thought the well-regulated militia clause meant more than it does today. Gun control politics continued to be driven not by everyday gun deaths, but by high-profile incidents that made the news. One was the assassination attempt on President Reagan in 1981 that left him injured and his press secretary, James Brady, partly paralyzed for life. It took more than a decade for the so-called Brady Bill to get through Congress. That's the background check law. And in 1989, a mass shooting at an elementary school in Stockton, California, spurred the modern assault weapons ban debate. Using an AK-47, the shooter killed five children and wounded 32 others, as reported on January 18, 1989, on KTVU in Oakland.
Stockton is culturally diverse, but this tragedy hit hardest the Asian community, especially Cambodian immigrants. Tonight, they mourned for their dead children. Six-year-old Sokim An, six-year-old Ram Chun, eight-year-old Oyen Lim, eight-year-old Rathanan Orr, and six-year-old Tui Tran.
We are part with their family. And,
you share their grief with them.
Yes, right.
All day long, people placed flowers on the Cleveland Elementary School sign. It became a shrine to those murdered children, to those innocents, senselessly cut down in the early blossom of their lives.
Just weeks later, on February 6, 1989, Ronald Reagan again spoke out in favor of gun control, for the Brady Bill's background checks, and for a ban on guns like AK-47s.
California has a system, unlike that of many other states, in which when you're going to buy a gun, you put down your money and you buy the gun, but you don't get to pick up the gun for several days, because investigation is then made to make sure that you're not a felon, that you don't have a record of bad conduct or that you are mental illness or anything, and then you can come back and get your gun. And I do not believe in taking away the right of the citizen to own guns for sporting, for hunting and so forth, or for home defense. But I do believe that an AK-47, a machine gun, is not a sporting weapon.
The Brady Bill finally passed in 1993. The assault weapons ban in 1994, after Bill Clinton was elected president. He devoted a minute and a half to both in his 1995 State of the Union address.
I don't want to destroy the good atmosphere in the room or in the country tonight, but I have to mention one issue that divided this body greatly last year. The last Congress also passed the Brady Bill, and in the crime bill, the ban on 19 assault weapons. I don't think it's a secret to anybody in this room that several members of the last Congress who voted for that aren't here tonight because they voted for it. And I know, therefore, that some of you who are here because they voted for it are under enormous pressure to repeal it. I just have to tell you how I feel about it. The members of Congress who voted for that bill and I would never do anything to infringe on the right to keep and bear arms, to hunt, and to engage in other appropriate sporting activities. I've done it since I was a boy, and I'm going to keep right on doing it until I can't do it anymore. But a lot of people laid down their seats in Congress so that police officers and kids wouldn't have to lay down their lives under a hail of assault weapon attack, and I will not let that be repealed.
President Clinton, in his 1995 State of the Union address, getting hissed there at one point. Did you hear that? Part of the backlash to the Clinton presidency, with eerie echoes today, I think this part is really important, was the so-called militia movement of the 1990s. I'm surprised more people aren't talking about this today, as the Donald Trump movement threatens to inspire a new generation of anti-government potential vigilantes. With the reference to the well-regulated militias in the Second Amendment, groups of citizens were arming themselves for the prospect of what they believed could be President Clinton and the United Nations coming to their homes to take away their rights. A reference from the time that became a conspiracy theory joke was the black helicopters from the UN would be the new police force. Who remembers the black helicopters if you were around then? One militia group leader was this man, Norm Olson, founder of the so-called Michigan Militia in 1994.
Enough is enough. What I need is liberty. What I need is freedom. And you need to listen very closely to what we're going to tell you this afternoon. We've had enough. Enough is enough. And I serve notice to all of the tyrants. I serve notice to FDR and the New Deal. I serve notice to Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. I serve notice to Bill Clinton that enough is enough. And we're here and we're not going to go away. Yeah. We've had it. Enough is enough. You've talked about wars of revolution. I talk about a war of liberation. I talk about securing something for our posterity that we need to do.
Michigan militia founder Norm Olson in 1994. In 95, stoked by anti-federal government revolutionary passion, like we just heard there, the militia movement culminated in the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building by Timothy McVeigh, killing 168 people and wounding hundreds more. After Oklahoma City, with a horrified public looking on, the militia movement faded. But so did the gun control movement. The assault weapons ban was not renewed when it expired and came before Congress. Al Gore, as the year 2000 Democratic nominee, did not emphasize gun control, which the party decided was a losing issue for them. The passion and the votes were on the Republican side that year, as in this famous moment. Actor and NRA leader Charlton Heston at the NRA convention, which preceded the Democratic and Republican conventions in July 2000, as he challenged Gore to make a big deal out of it, as he held a shotgun aloft for the cameras and proclaimed what it would take to get it off of him.
So as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
The incidents, of course, have kept coming. The assassination attempt on Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, leaving her brain impaired.
Speaking is difficult, but I need to say something important. Violence is a big problem. Too many children are dying. Too many children. We must do something.
Giffords was shot in 2011, and in 2012, it was Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, leading an emotional President Obama to recite the list of mass shooting victims at schools, from Columbine High School, from Virginia Tech.
And from first graders in Newtown. First graders. And from every family who never imagined that their loved one would be taken from our lives by a bullet from a gun. Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day. So, all of us need to demand a Congress brave enough to stand up to the gun lobby's lies. All of us need to stand up and protect its citizens. All of us need to demand governors and legislators and businesses do their part to make our community safer.
One of the very few times that President Obama actually broke down in tears while making a public address. And as we well know, President Obama's attempts to close loopholes in the Brady Bill background checks have met with Charlton Heston-like defiance. The head of the NRA these days, Wayne LaPierre, tried to change the subject after Newtown this way.
I call on Congress today to act immediately to appropriate whatever is necessary to put armed police officers in every single school in this nation, and to do it now, to make sure that blanket safety is in place when our kids return to school in January.
In Wayne LaPierre versus Barack Obama, in the politics of guns, history will record that Wayne LaPierre won during the years that Obama was president. And in recent Supreme Court history, he won there too. In 2008, the Supreme Court struck down Washington, D.C.'s city ordinance banning handguns. The Roberts Court held 5-4 that even with the well-regulated militia clause, the right to bear arms was about the individual. Justice Scalia during oral arguments.
I don't see how there's any contradiction between reading the second clause as a personal guarantee and reading the first one as assuring the existence of a militia, not necessarily a state-managed militia, because the militia that resisted the British was not state-managed. But why isn't it perfectly plausible, indeed reasonable, to assume that since the framers knew that the way militias were destroyed by tyrants in the past was not by passing a law against militias, but by taking away the people's weapons That was the way militias were destroyed. The two clauses go together beautifully. Since we need a militia, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Justice Scalia from the bench in 2008, the late Justice Scalia, of course, with interpretation of the Second Amendment on a 5-4 court, one of the reasons the presidential election today is so important. It's our 30 Issues election series, Issue 29, The Guns. Let's talk about some of that history with Robert Spitzer, political science professor at SUNY Cortland and author of Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights, published last year by the Oxford University Press. Professor Spitzer, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Yes, thank you. It's good to be with you.
And let's start with the Supreme Court. In 1939, as we heard, they upheld a ban on machine guns and sawed-off shotguns because those weapons wouldn't be used by state militias. They upheld the felons ban in 1980 on the grounds that, if I have my history right, legal guns would need to bear some reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia. And yet we heard Scalia on a whole other track there. Is there consistency in the Supreme Court's rulings, or did Scalia and company, in effect, overthrow those previous two?
Well, Justice Scalia and the five-member majority that he represented did, in effect, contradict not only Supreme Court rulings. There's a very important case from 1886 in the Supreme Court, a ruling called the Presser case that emphasizes, well, the militia basis of the Second Amendment. And in addition, there were nearly 50 lower federal court rulings from the early 1940s up until 2008 that all accepted and embraced the militia-based view. Now, when Justice Scalia wrote the Heller decision, he essentially marginalized the 1939 Miller case, which is the most recent significant Supreme Court case, and barely mentioned Lewis at all. And it was trying to minimize the idea that he was, in fact, contradicting past court rulings, but in fact he was, because he was, even though he didn't say it this way, he essentially took a red pen and crossed off the first half of the sentence that constitutes the Second Amendment by saying instead, look, it's not about militias at all, it's about a personal or individual right to have guns for personal self-protection in the home, and that's not related to militias.
Do you think the replacement of Scalia, coming from either Clinton or Trump, could matter to future gun rights versus gun control cases? Since it was 5-4, is this one that's likely to be revisited, and if Merrick Garland or somebody gets on the bench overturned?
That's a very good question. You might think that, let's say Hillary Clinton is elected president and she appoints a moderate to liberal judge. And by the way, there are many conservative judges who also disapprove of the court's reasoning and conclusions in the Heller case. And it is certainly possible that a fifth justice could be added that would constitute a fifth vote to modify or overturn Heller. But if you think about it a little more, I think that's really only one possibility. It's not at all given that the court might simply overturn Heller as a mistaken decision, partly because the court is reluctant to flatly overturn itself, and it doesn't do it very often, partly because the Heller decision, even as it stands, has really proven to be a fairly solid bulwark in favor of existing gun laws, because in the Heller decision, the Supreme Court said, yes, there's this individual right, but it also went to great pains to say that most existing gun laws probably were fine, especially if there's any historical provenance to gun laws. And from my work and the work of other people, interestingly enough, it turns out that there were literally thousands upon thousands of early gun laws dating from the literally from the 1600s up through the 1900s that in many respects were more restrictive than the laws we see today. And so if you're looking at history, history says, you know what, you really can regulate guns in just about any manner that you think is sane and sensible. And in fact, the court's decisions, they've received numerous appeals, over 70 appeals to decisions that almost uniformly upheld gun laws in lower court levels, and the Supreme Court, with a couple of exceptions, has refused to hear those appeals. And so the gist of case law has, by and large, upheld existing gun laws with literally one or two exceptions.
What are some early examples of gun laws in the United States? Since our history started really with the Firearms Control Act of 1934, which is generally seen as the first one by the federal government in this country's history.
Well, there were laws that barred dangerous or unusual weapons. There were laws that barred selling or giving weapons to various categories of people. Some of them are obvious, like Native Americans. But some colonies, before we were even states, had laws barring anybody who wasn't a Protestant from owning a gun. There were laws that required a loyalty oath if you wanted to keep your gun. You had to swear a loyalty oath to the colonial government. There were extensive laws. Virtually everywhere in America in the late 1700s and into the 1800s that barred concealed carrying of firearms almost uniformly across the country. And that, in fact, is one of the most distinctive differences between the 19th century and the present. I mean, we think of the 19th century, especially the Old West, as Americans, you know, carrying around their six-shooters and having gunfights left and right. But, in fact, gunfights were rare. And one of the very first things that local governments did as settlements spread westward in the 19th century was enact strict no-carry laws. And because they recognized and said so in their laws that if you were carrying a handgun around secretly, you know, hidden on your person, you were up to no good. And that was the presumption. That was the assumption at the time. And it was only since the early 1980s that most of those laws have been modified or overturned in the states. And, of course, we now have this odd situation where in 40 of the 50 states, it's quite easy to get a permit to carry a handgun. And in fact, in about 8 or 9 states, they have eliminated permitting entirely. And that was utterly at odds with the way laws were written back in the 19th century about restricting gun carrying by civilians.
What happened with the NRA? Why did they back the early gun control laws, and why did they flip?
That's a very good question. The NRA was formed not as a political organization, but as an organization to improve the shooting and marksmanship skills of especially militia-eligible men, because one of the lessons that came out of the Civil War was that the typical American militia-eligible or military-eligible man didn't know one end of a gun from the other. And so, you know, basic gun training had to be part of their training. And so two Civil War veterans formed the NRA to improve marksmanship skills, and shooting contests became fairly common. In the late 20s and early 30s, the NRA kind of was pulled into the political debate when, as you mentioned in your very good piece, that in 1934 Congress considered and passed the first significant national gun law. And so, you know, naturally calling on experts, officials of the NRA were called in to give their opinions. But the real turning point for the NRA came in 1977, when a very sort of radical faction within the NRA took control of the NRA because they felt that the NRA was not political enough and was not strong enough in protecting gun rights. And from that period of time, from 1977 on, the NRA became much more political. It devoted many more of its resources to political activities, and it became ever more extreme, so that we're at the point now where the NRA opposes essentially any kind of law. Even as late as the 1990s, Wayne LaPierre was on record as saying that he favored uniform background checks for purchases of guns. But today, of course, he does not support that or any other gun measure.
Do you think we've lost the power to be horrified by gun violence, even against children? We heard in the history how mafia killings of kids in the 1930s drove government to a law. The assassination and street violence of the 1960s led to new laws. The Stockton massacre, all but forgotten in today's debate, but such a big thing at the time with an AK-47 in 1989, led to the assault weapons ban. But these days, Newtown, Virginia Tech, Gabby Giffords, San Bernardino, and nothing. What changed?
Well, a couple things. One is, I think you're right that much of the American public has become inured or immunized essentially to stories of gun violence because they happen so frequently. It kind of becomes, I wouldn't say a typical news heading, but it becomes a depressingly common feature, and Americans, after a while, I think, just become immunized from those stories. In addition, in the previous decade, in the first decade of the 2000s, the second Bush administration was the most gun-friendly administration in American history. It significantly advanced gun rights arguments, of course, at the behest of the NRA, and it did so at a time when the Democratic Party and virtually all more liberal office holders and party leaders decided to avoid the gun issue just because it was too much trouble and they felt it hurt them at the polls in the very close 2000 presidential election. So nobody was really making the opposing argument. But things did change when Sandy Hook happened in December of 2012. And that really was a catalyzing moment for the gun safety movement, for many Democrats, including President Obama. And even though his efforts to change federal law failed in the spring of 2013, he has kept talking about the issue. He has encouraged others to do so. Hillary Clinton has brought the gun issue into the campaign. She did so very expressly and early on. So it's kind of back on the agenda. And I think you can argue that the country may be slowly moving back the other way to where not only we already know that most Americans, overwhelming majorities of Americans and of gun owners support most of the gun measures that are being debated today, but to a point where the NRA's ability to block any such actions may be diminishing.
It's our 30 Issues election series, issue 29, The Guns, and that's our 30 Issues audio history and conversation for this week. We'll compare the candidates tomorrow. Then on Thursday, we'll talk to Black Panther's co-founder Bobby Seale about African Americans and guns then and now. We thank Robert Spitzer, political science professor at SUNY Cortland and the author of Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. Thank you so, so much.
Good to speak with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay tuned.